Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Risky Business for 2009. I'm Patrick Gray. And we actually have a new sponsor who's bringing the show to you this week, which is Sophos. So, yay, Sophos. Thanks a lot, guys and gals. Now, before we get into this week's show, there's a little bit of housekeeping to draw our attention towards. Firstly, you can now get yourself onto Risky Business by leaving a voicemail message at a couple of voicemail boxes we've set up in Australia and the USA. Australian listeners can ring 02-8569-1835. That's 02-8569-1835. And you can leave feedback, tips, rants and corrections. And once you've left your message, we can choose to play it on next week's show. Unless, of course, you don't want us to. If you're in the USA, you can call, of course, country code 1. Toll free, 877-688-8417. And that's a toll-free number, and of course you can do the same as what I just mentioned for the Australian number. So I look forward to hearing from you guys out there in security land. And I should mention that both voicemail boxes are only protected by a four-digit PIN, so you don't win a prize if you own them. You just ruin everyone's fun. Now, I did mention last year that our new website will be ready soon, and it will be. But we've hit a few snags. Development is well and truly underway these days, and finally, and we should have a fully featured site with forums and blogs, hopefully video and all of that good stuff, up and running by March sometime. So stay tuned for updates. But now it's time to get on with the show at hand, and on this week's show, we're just sort of easing back into the year. You know, no heavy topics, no huge big-name guests. We're just having a general chit-chat in this week's feature with industry stalwart Greg Shipley about what's hot and what's not at the moment. It seems the biggest problem a lot of CSOs out there are facing is what to buy that will actually do any good. There seems to be a real lack of simple, effective protection out there, and, you know, hey, how do you spend that budget when a lot of this stuff is quite ineffective? We'll also have a chat about the effect of the GFC. Now, of course, those who aren't au fait with business acronyms, that stands for the Global Financial Clusterfuck. We'll find out what effect the GFC is having on IT security budgets in the enterprise, and that, of course, is coming up later. Also coming up later is our sponsor interview, and I've got to say the best thing about securing Sophos as our new sponsor, as one of our new sponsors, is once a month we get to speak to their staffer, Paul Ducklin. Now, a lot of Australian listeners would know Paul. He's been around the traps for a long, long time, and he's a true geek. He even once got NetBSD working on his HP Jornada 720p PDA, which is a computer he describes as being both ahead and behind its own time, if that kind of makes sense. Duck is also a very skilled malware analyst and a funny guy to boot, so he'll be popping in every 4 weeks to chat to us. But this week he's joining us to discuss a very prevalent bit of malware, Konfigger, which seems to have enjoyed considerable success spreading via USB drives, among other things. So he's along soon with some pretty sharp analysis on all of that. But first, we're joined by our roving news analyst and good friend Munir Kataria to take a look at the week's news. But before we get into that, Mun, how the hell was your summer?
Oh, fantastic. It's going great. Sydney is just scorching.
You know what I did? You know what I did all summer, 6 weeks? I did nothing, Munir. I did nothing. And you know what? It was everything that I dreamed it could be.
Oh, it's been fantastic. It's been such a good break. I'm just looking forward to my next huge break now.
Now, I understand that tomorrow at 8 a.m. you are flying out to where?
We're starting off in Singapore, and then the round-the-world trip will commence.
Excellent. And you're not due back till when? November at this stage, right?
At the moment, it's the 11th of November, but you know what? Who can tell? I may run out of money and be back in March.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think that's quite likely.
But you know me better than most.
It looks like you truly will be our roving reporter. So I think you'll be, you know, we might have to check in with you at some opium den in rural China.
There's always a chance of that. Yeah, I will be looking for one.
You just never know. Now, let's see. News. Now, I tell you what, the best thing about having a 6-week break is when you come back, there's a lot of news. And look, at the top of the news list this week is a funny story. I mean, well, you know, it's not funny if you're the victim, but it's pretty funny for everyone else, which is Kanye West's pretty much digital everything got owned, and people started sending out some pretty silly communications purporting to be from him.
It's quite funny. Yeah, apparently he wrote on his blog or something, all in capitals, shouting at everyone, telling them how they should just let him be great because his Gmail, his MySpace, his Twitter has all gone down, and they're all saying that he's going to start a new career as a bisexual porn star.
Yeah, he said, I want to do porn. You know, if there's dudes involved, whatever, people might think it's a bit weird, but hey, you know, that's how I roll.
But the hackers have really got it in for him, mate. I mean, there's like 12 unauthorized Skype accounts in his name, and his Twitter account, and all sorts of stuff's going on.
So there you go.
Seeing that the hackers have finally got a sense of humor.
Finally, I don't know, man. There were some pretty funny defacements back in the day. But, yeah, it's just funny, like, seeing all these celebrities get a hard time. And there was that big Twitter breach a while ago. And, yeah, there's been
He hasn't lost any cash. No one's tried to steal his idea or anything, have they?
I don't think so. But there is a pretty high-profile case of that we'll get to in a minute. But next up, you know, something a little bit more serious here in Australia, which is, some shady types, shall we say, actually hacked into a New South Wales government website used to advertise public service jobs.
This is really interesting because that happened, was it last week or so, and the site is still down now. And apparently people who had applied for jobs with the New South Wales government got emails offering the perfect job and asking them to, as the usual, click on a link and then go and give them all their details, basically.
Yeah, now, according to this story, which is written by Asher Moses from the Sydney Morning Herald, the people started getting very targeted phishing attacks directed towards them after they signed up with this jobs.nsw.gov.au site, which is maintained by the Department of Commerce. So it's a pretty big deal.
It is. I looked it up this morning, and yeah, they've still got, the big message saying that the site is down for maintenance.
Yeah. Read that as site is down for complete rebuild. Interestingly enough, I actually wrote a story for the Sydney Morning Herald, I think it was probably a year before last, about the Department of Commerce experiencing some major problems with their gateway. They were getting so much spam that it actually knocked their entire gateway offline for a couple of days,
right.
And they couldn't get any work done or anything. So they're having some security problems, these dudes.
Yeah, I wonder how long the site will be down for. Keep watching that one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it just goes to show us that web applications, you know, securing web applications is not straightforward, so they're probably just doing a line-by-line audit to figure out how it happened in the first place. This one was absolutely hilarious. This Kiwi guy who bought an MP3 player, this news is, it's last week as well, it's a little bit old, but a Kiwi guy who bought an MP3 player from a charity shop in Oklahoma found 60 US military files, including names and telephone numbers for American soldiers, like it was on the device, and some of them were apparently flagged top secret. So there you go.
Quite strange. In the Northern Advocate paper in New Zealand, they go on add a bit more detail, and they say it also had details of American troop movements in Europe and also information about procedures to follow after a nuclear attack.
Well, yes, die a long, slow, painful death, vomiting
duck
blood.
And cover.
Yes. See, duck and cover, yeah, hide under the nearest table, that'll work. It used to be duck and cover under a desk, and now what is it? It's fridge magnets and sea-size batteries, they say, in the event of a terrorist attack. But what's really funny about this, I heard the bloke actually interviewed on, I think it was ABC Radio last week, and he said that the US Embassy sent some guys around to talk to him and said that they were very reasonable and very polite and stuff, and just really asked him questions about where he got it from. And all he asked for in return was a replacement MP3 player, and they bought him one.
Apparently he got 4 gigs and his was only a 256 meg one.
There you go. So he got his MP3 player in the end, which I think is all he cared about. And also making a bit of fun of the US military establishment, which is always good value. Oh, now this is a more recent yarn, which is quite interesting. A couple of nights ago, Google users were confronted every time every search returned back every result with a malware warning on it.
Finally, someone like turned the truth on the interweb tubes.
Yeah.
It's like every site is vulnerable. Even Google itself, actually.
If you search for google.com, it's like this site may harm your computer, you know? So every single search result came up with that. Now, interestingly enough, I just got wind of another angle to this story, which is that it screwed up their spam filtering on Gmail as well. I don't know if it was a related screw up or not, but they're still trying to figure out. They were actually sending legitimate mail to spam boxes for a little while for Gmail accounts, and they're still trying to basically retrospectively sort them out and put them back into people's inboxes. But it looks like, yeah, a little bit of a uncharacteristic cluck up at Google.
It is. I think it's quite good, though, that finally, you know, it shows that even those guys at Google can screw up big time.
They are human.
Yes.
That's nice. Now, we mentioned earlier that there was a very significant victim of identity theft, and that is the man with the golden tonsils, we call him here in Australia, who's a broadcaster who's been on air since something like 1852. His name's John Laws, and he's one of those sort of right-wing shock jock types, and he's been totally owned.
Yeah, that's right. I think, yeah, he's been broadcasting, what, 45 years? He retired a couple of years ago, so didn't he?
Yeah.
And, yeah, they say that, the police have actually arrested some people in a gang, haven't they?
Yeah, there was a big crew of these guys doing all sorts of fraud. They stole millions of dollars by manipulating personal details like bank statements and stuff that are mailed to private homes. And, they've laid 400 charges against these guys, so I'd say they're in a bit of...
Guys.
Yeah, I think they're going to be in a little bit of trouble, but it's just funny that they would have known who this guy was, and they did it anyway. I mean, I'm always sort of averse to making powerful enemies, but didn't seem to stop them.
They're going to be in a lot of trouble, I reckon.
Yes, they call it, what is it? He actually had a solid gold microphone that he used to use, that guy.
Yeah, that got stolen as well, didn't it?
It did get stolen, I think, and they replaced it, but
right.
I'm not using a gold microphone. It's not here. So if there are any police listening, don't look here. Anyway, now this is very interesting that cybersecurity, as we sometimes call it, I guess, and cybercrime is actually getting a bit of attention at the World Economic Forum in Davos.
Oh, that's right. Apparently online theft costs $1 trillion a year.
Bullshit.
$1 trillion.
Bullshit. Bullshit. Excuse me. 1 trillion, that's equivalent to the gross domestic product of Australia. Do you believe that figure?
We've had so many silly figures thrown around. I've got no idea what to believe.
I think that one was courtesy of a study done by McAfee. I mean, not like it's in their interests to inflate that statistic or anything.
I do find it interesting there that, yes, they say that they can't attribute the quotes to any particular person, but it just happens at the same time McAfee put out a thing saying all the same information. So I think it's safe to say that it was McAfee.
Yeah, it's part of the rules for these panels they have at the World Economic Forum is when there are panelists speaking, journalists can quote them but not quote the individual panelists. I think that's not a bad rule because it keeps the attention focused on the issue rather than on the individual. But, it's pretty obvious in this instance where that figure came from. But, Jesus, I mean, a trillion, it just does not seem realistic to me. I mean, if some, you know, reputable university did a study like that and came up with that figure, I'd probably give it more credence. But given that it came from a company that makes its money selling software, you know, good software, admittedly, you know, they make some good kit, but it doesn't wash.
I have no idea where they get these figures from. It just makes no sense. But I don't know. It could be. It probably isn't, though.
Yeah, I wonder if he's shaved his head and he's taken to putting his little finger on his chin there, you know, $1 trillion.
Yeah.
Maybe next year it'll be a gazillion. Who knows?
Well, I hope so. We look forward to that.
But a trillion? Anyway, what is it? That's more than the US bailout package.
No, that was more than that, wasn't it?
No, it was 700 billion, wasn't it?
Billion. Yeah.
Yeah, they're one trillion.
Maybe
that's 1,000.
The same as, invading Iraq. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? But it just strikes me as being a bit high. But good to see it's getting some attention at the upper levels. Now, of course, there was also a massive data breach over our summer period and the American winter, which is payment processor Heartland Payment Systems has been thoroughly pwned. And now they're being sued over the breach that they publicly disclosed on the day that Obama was inaugurated.
Yeah, that's right. It just happens that they picked that day to announce that more than 100 million credit and debit card transactions had been exposed, or may have been exposed.
Not like they were hoping it'd go under the radar or anything, or skip the news cycle. You know, what a cunning plan. I mean, really, hey, we'll announce it on Inauguration Day and no one will notice.
I love that the lawsuit, it says it seeks damages and relief for the inexplicable delay, questionable timing.
And inaccuracies concerning the disclosures. Yeah, so it looks like those guys are going to be in a little bit of poo-poo. But, I mean, as if they're not already, 100 million credit card numbers, it's believed to be the biggest breach in US history. So, you know, I think we're really entering a time this year where we're going to have to start questioning the entire credit card model because, really, What the banks are essentially doing is giving all and sundry, any merchant out there, the ability to debit from an account, which is just, it just strikes me as nuts. I mean, maybe we need to move to a model where if you want to pay someone, you go to your bank and instruct the bank to pay them, you know, via some sort of credit account. But, you know, having the credit card system's balked, I think that's really what we've had to come to realize, don't you?
Yeah, it's all about convenience, though, isn't it? I mean, all these debit things happen because people didn't want to bother every month to go and actually have to do something to go and pay their bills. They wanted them to come and get their bills. So if you want convenience, there's going to be risks, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but I don't know. I mean, couldn't you just go to your bank and say, you know, every month it's okay to credit this bill in this sort of range? If this bill comes in at, you know, $80 to $100, just credit it. Do you know what I mean? And you're instructing the bank on you put limits on the bank for your regular things. And, you know, if you want to just do a one-off payment, you just do it through the bank. I just think it just means instead of all that sensitive information being splattered all over the internet, you've still just got it held in one place.
That could be a good idea. I hope some bankers are listening.
Yeah, you bloody pack of bankers. Because the banks are so popular at the moment. God.
Oh, yes.
Now, look, and I'm sure there's good reasons they haven't done it yet, but shit, you know, we'll see what happens this year. This next story is a real story for the Times, which is a disgruntled ex-employee of Fannie Mae, which is, of course, one of those huge mortgage holding companies in the US, has been indicted on charges of planning to basically nuke the mortgage agency's computers.
Yeah, and this guy had root access to all of the company's servers, and he was setting up. He was in charge of some scripts and stuff, and he basically set one to go as soon as he was let go that same afternoon, and or that evening rather, because they hadn't cut off his privileges.
Yeah,
and luckily they actually found it before it did any damage.
Yeah, it was intended to execute on the 31st of January, and now this guy is in a world of pain. You know, look, it is really a story for the Times, which is there's going to be a lot of people getting laid off, and you can imagine the effect that sort of event would have had on Fannie Mae, given all that's happened in the in world markets. So, look, it's kind of quite. Quite a fortunate thing that they managed to catch it. But, you know, I think we're going to see a little bit more of this sort of thing, don't you?
I do. And the other thing I think this should really bang any lesson home is that if you do let somebody go who has that kind of privilege, then cut them off immediately. Don't wait until that evening or the next day or whenever you feel like it. If you find them, get rid of them. Walk them out the building.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, but then again, he might have seen it coming. I don't know. Like, it's not an easy thing, especially when you're dealing with guys who've got root access, because, you know, there's a lot of admins out there, and whether we like it or not, they do burrow themselves pretty deeply into systems, and if they've got root access, they can set up other accounts and stuff and skip past auditing software, and it's not always easy to just remove someone who's had that sort of god level of access on a network. So, I guess it's something.
It is a tough one, but, you know. You have to be careful, and I guess maybe that's why they caught it in the first place, because they did go through and look carefully.
Yeah, I guess they almost certainly had multiple admins with sort of privileged access, and that's really what you've got to do these days, is because, you know, you put one person, you give them exclusive access to all of this stuff, and you're just you're going to be in a world of pain.
Yeah.
All right, Moon, that takes us to the end of the news. Can you believe it? We're back on air.
I'm very excited. It's going to be a good 2009.
Yeah, and I guess we'll talk to you. I mean, where are you going to be next week?
Next week, who can tell? Probably Malaysia, could be Borneo, could be back in Singapore, could be back in Sydney. Who can tell?
All right, well, maybe we'll cut to a cross. We can chat to you while you're on the beach in Borneo.
Oh, I reckon we can sort something out, yeah.
Okay, Moon, thanks a lot, and have a safe flight, mate. Enjoy your trip.
Thanks, mate. Talk to you soon.
ZDNet Australia's Munir Katadia there with a look at the week's news headlines. And we'll try to check in with Moon as often as we can while he's off exploring the planet. And we'll just have to see how we go with that. But now it is time to chat to a good friend of mine, Greg Shipley, who is the founder and CTO of NeoHapsis, a very well-respected information security consultancy based in Chicago. Greg's probably best known for writing the torturous reviews of security equipment that used to run back in the day in Network Computing magazine. NeoHapsis Labs would evaluate equipment, and Greg would write up these really detailed reviews. So, you know, if you wanted to know if an IDS or a firewall or, you know, VPN appliance was any good, you'd pretty much read the Neo reviews in Network Computing magazine. They don't do it anymore, but, you know, I'm just telling you that by way of background. Now, of course, Neo's lab reviews were extremely influential, and they also forged Greg's rather cynical outlook. And ever since Greg did that work, if you want someone to tell you what's wrong in the world of security and what vendors are doing wrong, Greg's been the man, and that's our topic today. So, Greg, you know, you've always been very critical of general software vendors and security vendors. Has much actually changed over the last few years?
Well, I think some things have. You know, I think mainstream IT vendors have started to realize that the security of their own products is something the consumer cares about. So I think there's definitely been improvements on the quality assurance side and bug handling and industry outreach programs and that type of stuff. So, I definitely think companies like Microsoft have improved software quality, and there's other companies that still have a ways to go. But, yeah, I think on average things have improved. However, one could suggest that the effectiveness of a lot of security products has actually gone down quite a bit.
Well, now this is the interesting part, isn't it? Say you have an IT security budget of, I don't know, $1 million, just for simplicity's sake, for your enterprise. What do you spend that money on to get protection? What is out there that can really effectively mitigate all of these threats that we're faced with?
Yeah, I think that's certainly a good question. I think, though, that one of the things that we miss as an industry is figuring out exactly what it is that we're trying to protect. I mean, I can't even tell you how many organizations I talk to that don't actually have a good sense of where all their assets are and where all their information comes from and where it goes and where it's stored. So I think the first thing a lot of organizations have to do is kind of get back to the basics as far as figuring out what they've got, what threats are against it, and figuring out what's the first, second, and third priority to protect. And then moving out from there, I think you can start talking about specific controls and specific technology. And there's some no-brainers. But, yeah, I think a lot has been missed on kind of going after specific threats or throwing specific technology at issues that's created more problems than it probably has solved.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, you know, it's quite important for organizations to be able to classify their information and figure out what they're trying to protect in the first place, because that seems to be the pitch of DLP vendors.
Yeah, well, I think DLP vendors, there's certainly issues with that product space, but I think they're kind of on to the right thing, which is find the stuff that's the most valuable and keep a sharper eye on it. I mean, one of the things, you kind of watch the evolution of security products, and they've really started off with a lot of catch-all type approaches that have failed miserably. I mean, you go back to the original pitches of intrusion detection systems and intrusion prevention systems. I mean, the high-level message is, hey, you know, we have these attack signatures, and we'll go ahead and we'll identify attacks against everything, and we'll try and block everything, and you'll be a lot safer. And, well, it's certainly true that intrusion detection systems and prevention systems have blocked things and identified things. I think, for the most part, a lot of people, after they've been using them for years and years and years, I mean, they provide some value, but do they provide a holistic method of, you know, protecting your organization? Certainly not. So I think DLP vendors are on the right track in that they're saying, hey, look, there's certain types of information you really got to stay on top of, and we'll help you track that and identify that. So I think it's getting a little closer, but it's still got a long way to go. And the folks that have implemented DLP, if you can even call it successfully, I mean, a lot of them wind up with just more work, because now they have alerts rolling in their security operations centers that are saying, hey, you know, we identified this, this, and this, and then the person on the other end of that console has got to go figure out, well, was that authorized? Is that proper? Is that, you know, is that something we have to chase down, or is it something that just is done throughout the normal course of business? So, yeah, it's on the right path, but I think we probably still have a ways to go.
Yeah. Now, one of the technologies that you've been fiercely critical of in the past is anti-malware software. And I wonder, is that one of those technologies that you believe has become increasingly ineffective?
Yeah, I think the biggest danger with and the antivirus industry, specifically anti-malware products, I've been critical of it, not just because of its relative effectiveness, but a false sense of security that it provides. And so I think, does it reduce some of the threats out there? Yeah, absolutely. But to what level of effectiveness? And the thing I worry about is when I look at the average organization and they have X amount of expectations around their anti-malware deployment. So regardless of which vendor they've chosen, and some vendors do their job better than others, but regardless of what vendor they've chosen, when I corner system and network administrators and I say, hey, you know, what do you think the relative effectiveness of your anti-malware infrastructure is? You know, they'll probably come up with, you know, I think it's 80% effective or 90% effective, and that's kind of the assumptions they've built into their risk model. So they assume X amount of effectiveness, and they take a look at this control, and they say, okay, you know, I think I mitigated all the risks related to malware? No, but I think I've covered 80 to 90%. Well, the reality of the matter is I think the number is probably more like 30 or 40%. And one of the things that we really want to do in 09 is kind of nail that down a little bit more objectively. But, you know, we've had a number of customers that have actually started running internal tests, and that's about the range they're getting back, is 30 to 40%. And the other thing is we do a ton of incident response work, and some, you know, we do work on definite organizations that have been compromised and credit card numbers have been lost. And a lot of times it's done via Trojans and various pieces of malware. And these organizations definitely had antivirus deployed. So there's only so many incident response projects you can do where they've been running AV and there's clearly Trojans and malware in their boxes, where you start questioning the effectiveness of it.
Well, Go on, sorry.
I was going to say yes, absolutely. You know, I am critical of it, but I'm critical of it not just of its overall effectiveness, but also because I think as a community, we're giving it too much credit.
Well, I think they're making some steps in the right direction. I mean, there's a lot of this exploit detection stuff starting to take off, which is showing at least some promise. In addition to adding whitelisting capabilities to the products to complement the blacklists and sort of use those two components to tune up their heuristics a bit better. I mean, do you see that there's some hope on the horizon, or you really think it's?
Yeah, I think the whitelist approach is a good one. There's a lot of religious wars between, well, you can't secure a large organization with just using whitelists, and there's other people that are, you know, obviously pointing to blacklisting is not a working model either. And I think you're right. I think what we'll wind up gravitating towards are hybrid products that can combine both whitelist and blacklist functionality. And of course heuristics is the sexy answer that everyone kind of points toward, but I got to be honest, I haven't seen any vendors come to the table with really tangible offerings in the heuristics area that have actually been enabled or effective. But to answer your question, I think we're headed down the right path. My concern is that we're probably still a ways out, and I think part of that problem is awareness. I think more organizations would be checking out whitelisting technology if they truly understood how ineffective a lot of their antivirus technology was.
Now, of course, this is a strange time to be talking about where to spend your budget with. I mean, I don't know if you heard, but the economy is in what modern economists would call a death spiral. So I'd imagine there's a few people out there getting their budgets clipped. Where do you think people are going to cut from their security budgets?
Well, you know, I'm always hesitant to comment on global trends when my direct observations are more North American centric. But I can tell you what, you know, when I've talked to IT managers and directors and CIOs of large organizations, at least in North America, there is definitely trimming on the IT side. I haven't seen a ton of trimming on the security side. Now, you know, that raises the question of, well, is the security budget coming out of the IT budget? And that, of course, varies per organization. But I think what a lot of what I've seen has been kind of a wait and see attitude. So there's folks that definitely have had their budgets trimmed, but I think there's a lot of folks that are sitting around saying, okay, you know, I'm going to hold off in the first or second quarter, and let's see how things turn out. Let's see how Q2 ends up, and then maybe we'll start spending in Q3. But what I will say is, I think a lot of organizations are hesitant to start investing in new platforms or new technologies. I think there's a lot of folks that are looking internally and saying, hey, what were those painful projects that we didn't get done yet, that we haven't embarked on, but don't involve us going out and spending a ton of money on hardware and software. So to answer your question, you know, what do I think is getting trimmed? Well, on average, I don't see security getting that trimmed, at least not in North America. But I do see a lot of people being a little bit more hesitant in adopting another Band-Aid.
The problem with waiting and seeing what happens in a death spiral is that it's a death spiral. they don't tend to end well, Greg.
Well, I guess the question then is you know, what do we define death as far as our global economy is? And so without getting into economic theory, yeah, I think we can summarize it with 2009 is going to be awful, but I think we'll come out of it, and I think we'll start seeing the early signs of it late this year.
Well, I hope not to run into you on the breadlines, my friend. Thank you very much for joining us and giving a bit of a spray to the to all the vendors out there in vendor land. And mate, we'll have you back on the show shortly.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me.
Greg Shipley on the line from Chicago there. Thanks, Greg, for chatting to us in one of your evenings. Now, it's time for this week's sponsor interview, of course, with Paul Ducklin from Sophos. Risky Business makes its money by selling these sponsor slots. We have four sponsors, and each week one of them gets to come onto the show to shed a little bit of light on current events from their perspective. And this week we're talking about the Conficker malware, which is apparently everywhere. So, Paul, tell us all about Conficker, the strangely named malware that makes for a very funny typo.
Yes, be careful. Don't type a U at any point in it.
No.
Well, it's very interesting because it's pretty widespread at the moment. I wouldn't go so far as to say we're in an outbreak situation compared to the days of Slammer, Sasser, Blaster, but we certainly have a single family of malware that's very widespread. One reason for that is it can spread in three different ways: via an exploit, via weak passwords, and via USB keys inadvertently inserted.
What's the exploit? I presume it's some sort of IE thing?
No, it's not, actually. It's MS-08-067, which is a Windows RPC exploit.
Oh, fun. Good old network
so it's,
one.
It's hey. Sort of like Sasser, but different.
Yeah, so it'd be a hit with the LANs.
Yes, ironically, in my testing on XP0, which you'd imagine would be completely sort of wide open to everything, the computers that are attacked by the exploit just seem to freeze, which is rather a giveaway, and they don't get infected. On XP2, I'm sorry to say, it's actually able to spread quite effectively. So if you haven't applied that patch, I strongly suggest that you are about a month overdue.
We've heard conflicting reports, I suppose, or conflicting estimates of how widespread this thing is, anywhere between sort of, you know, 500,000 systems and 9 million, depending on who's issuing the press release. What's your take on how widespread this stuff is?
Yeah, I'm a little bit sceptical of some of the reports. It seems that 10 million is some kind of mid-range figure, and there are some people who are saying, well, we estimate that it's about 10 million, but we estimate that our estimation is an underestimate, which seems to be a way of saying, hey, we want you to write this up, and it's probably even worse than we're saying. And then there are other people saying, well, it's about 10 million, but our estimate may be an overestimation. So, ooh, it's a big thing, we want you to write it up, but I don't want to go down in history as an exaggerator. We know it's not at outbreak levels, at least here in Sophos, compared to viruses of the past, because nobody's had to take pizzas up to support yet.
Now, look, my initial reading on this is some sort of giant botnet in the making and possibly something we're seeing in response to the closure of McColo.
Well, there's a sort of secret feature. It's not very secret, it's pretty obvious, but there's a buried feature in Config which allows it to download code from a remote location. And shades of a virus from about the year 2000 called Hybris, it'll only download and run stuff which is cryptographically signed correctly, so it makes it hard for you to determine, you know, the code that's going to run. And it does this by generating using a pseudo random number generator a series of domain names which change on a roughly day by day basis. So the idea being that the bad guys at some future time know roughly what's coming and they can register those domains just in time. Now, some observers are saying that these domains are now, because now we know the algorithm to generate them, these domains are so tainted that no ISP is going to touch them because they will get macoloed immediately, and that may be a good thing. So some people are saying that all the hype and fuss around this has actually served us well because it will stop ISPs from inadvertently assisting the bad guys because they'll be on the lookout for these dodgy domain names.
Well, I was going to say, why hasn't some good netizen gone out and actually registered those domains so that they can control them and just park them somewhere?
Well, some people have registered some domains. It's a bit of a big ask to register all of them, particularly since some of them are never going to be used. It's an awful lot of money being frittered away and a lot of time in registering. I think leaving them dark is probably a better result. Mm. Obviously, registering some of them and then watching what happens gives you some insight into how widespread this thing is, and that's where some of our, 10 million infected computer stats come from. Though I suspect that those stats may have counted some computers more than once on networks that get partially cleaned and then reinfected. In other words, some of the computers on those nets will come up twice or thrice.
It seems like a bit of an amateur mistake, doesn't it, to actually rely on domain registrations to do the actual update process. I mean, they didn't really deploy the really nasty stuff on the systems. They just thought, hey, we'll get it to pull stuff down later. Maybe they weren't expecting this thing to be so widespread?
Well, it's always hard to guess what the bad guys are up to. If you haven't got the source code, you can't meet them, you can't ask them. My suspicion is that, yes, there may have been an element of surprise, because after all, the techniques used for spreading, USB, exploit, weak passwords, we've seen those in, thousands or tens of thousands of blended threat worms over the past few years. So, maybe the bad guys are as surprised as some of us are that this thing is as big as it has become, because my suspicion is there are any number of worms in the past while which could have gone this large. As for why they are using domains which will only be registered in the future, I guess that just keeps you one step removed. So it makes it that little bit harder to plan a response in advance.
And I guess, look, if it had a lower distribution on it, people wouldn't necessarily analyze it to the extent of working out the algorithm by which the domains are generated. That's what makes me think that it's perhaps been more successful than these guys anticipated.
Yeah, and let's hope that there's a real silver lining in all of that, because history has shown in the past, when we've had viruses that have gone much larger than we might at first have expected, there's at least been a 4 to 8 week kind of period of satisfaction afterwards when everyone's gone, right, we are going to take this patching seriously, we're going to do a password review, we're going to have a look at those policies and how we enforce them. So maybe we'll get some comparative relief afterwards as a fortunate side effect.
What's the penetration of this thing been like in the enterprise versus consumer?
This is only opinion. We can't prove this because obviously some people never work out how the thing got in. But it seems that in the corporate space, most infections are actually getting in via USB keys, not via exploits. And that stands to reason. Many companies, particularly in Australia, have become pretty good about patching. They've got their corporate border firewalls pretty locked down, mainly as a result of what happened in the SQL Slammer worm, where they realized, gosh, we've got all these systems that are on the internet that really shouldn't be. So they seem to be somewhat protected against automated attacks from outside, but unfortunately that walk me past the firewall problem of USB keys is, as you mentioned earlier, a problem that we haven't yet solved.
Now, I'm quite curious about this. I mean, I don't know if you saw it, but some time ago, CERT actually sent out an advisory which said that Microsoft, in Windows, when you try to disable certain auto-run features on USB U3 devices, it doesn't actually work properly, and you have to actually go in and manually start editing registry keys and stuff. Does this take advantage of that inability of Microsoft's Windows to easily disable U3 auto-run?
Ah, U3 is an entire new can of worms, if you'll pardon the overused pun.
That's okay, at least you didn't say it's a silver bullet or low-hanging fruit.
It's certainly not a silver bullet, unless that bullet's pointing directly at the user. Microsoft, for once in their lives, bless their hearts, did something pretty good with XP Service Pack 2, and they at least turned full automatic, you know, auto run. In other words, you plug in a USB key, and based on files on the USB key, something automatically launches. That was systematically disabled in XP Service Pack 2. So what happens next? Well, we get the so-called U3 USB key. And what that does is when you plug it in, it lies to the operating system, claims to be two pieces of hardware. One of them is a CD drive, and the other is a flash drive. And CD autoplay, or auto run, true auto run, is still on by default because it's comparatively unusual to get widespread infected CDs. So what the U3 keys are doing is you plug them in, the operating system believes you've stuck in a CD, it auto-launches a program off the CD part, which is typically only about 6 meg, and guess what? That's a program launcher for the USB part of the drive.
And that loads up the drivers and allows it to access, you know, larger than usual USB keys, right?
That, or indeed to do anything. In other words, it completely subverts subverts the protection that you had against auto-run by leveraging auto-run. Imagine that you put in a CD and a USB drive at the same time, and the CD was somehow leaning towards launching the USB key. So what we've had to do in our software is we've provided an application control element which will actually inhibit the execution of the magic launching program off the U3 key.
I mean, like, Duck, good on you guys for doing that, but, you know, you really shouldn't have to use endpoint security software to do that for you, should you?
Well, you can probably work out what my opinion of U3 keys are. You know, Microsoft tried to do the right thing, and the immediate response from the hardware guys was, hey, let's work around that, which seems to be a little crazy. I would have thought that the advantages of this magic auto-running U3 business are strongly outweighed by the risks.
Before we go, Doug, I just wanted to ask you, it seems from the conversation that we've just had that Conficker is a bit of a fizzer. Even though it's quite widespread, it doesn't seem to be particularly damaging because these domains are being watched.
I would suggest that, you know, if you have to give someone advice and they know they've got the virus in their network right now, then it's not like in 1998 on the 25th of April when you had one day to get rid of the CIH virus before it flashed your BIOSes. Mm. You know, so you don't have to fix this in an hour or 2 hours, so don't go and do anything silly. On the other hand, since we don't know what's going to happen in the future, you haven't got weeks to deal with it either. And if you do take weeks to fix it, then you're just going to be typhoid marrying the rest of the population. So if you do have the thing, you have the luxury of removing it cleanly, but that will take, in many networks, that can be a concerted effort. And if you haven't started yet, then I'd suggest that you give it a go right away.
Okay, mate. Well, thank you very much for the solid advice, and we'll speak to you again in a month.
Thanks, Patrick. Cheers.
Ducklin from Sophos there, rounding out this week's show. And yes, it did strike me that Ducklin is also a word that you would not want to mistype. And that's all we got time for this week, but we will be back soon. Risky Business will be updating every week until Christmas from here on in, so don't forget to subscribe if you're a first-time listener, and don't forget to leave some feedback on our voicemail boxes if you've got something to say about the topics we've covered this week, or even if you just want to have a go at us, you've got a news tip, whatever. That's what they're there for. The music you're hearing is by a band called Firewalk, F-Y-A-H, Walk. And they've just released this album, and you can, I'm sure if you Google around for it, you can actually order it online. It's very good stuff, and if you get a chance to see them live, they're a lot of fun as well. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.